This week on Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. One of Britain's most distinctive and adventurous filmmakers, Ben Hopkins, joins me to discuss his film The Market, a comic smuggler's tale from the borders of Turkey and Azerbaijan. From a smuggler to a snuggler, Andrew Bujalski's off-kilter romance Beeswax is out this week. I'll be talking to the American filmmaker about crafting a film on a nano budget and how he coined the term he now hates, mumblecore. Peter Bradshaw will be joining me to review Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant's foray onto the big screen in Cemetery Junction, Ewan McGregor and Pierce Brosnan in Roman Polanski's The Ghost, and Jude Law and Forest Whitaker are all heart in Repo Men. Forget about election season, this is an arty cinematical podcast on behalf of Film Weekly.
Hey, indirim yapalım.
Of Allah'ım, of ya. Nedir bu dünyanın hali?
Geliyor mihram, çekilin yoldan. Geliyor mihram. A flavour of The Market there, where our protagonist, the small-time Turkish hustler Mihram, played by Tayanç Ayadin, attempts to pull off a big deal that will land him the cash he needs to launch his mobile phone business. To tell me more about Mihram's adventures, I'm joined by the man who made them up and made the film, whose career is not dissimilar to Mihram's plight, it seems to me. Ben Hopkins, a warm welcome to Film Weekly. Lovely to see you.
Thank you.
I mean that in the highest praise possible, because it does seem to me that this film, which is about sort of impecunity and sort of the struggle to get things made, remain independent, is something that mirrors your own career, because you're a British filmmaker who's had to sort of look abroad to kind of get his films made.
Yeah, I mean, it's a struggle to make films anyway, but especially like me, to try and make films in which I have final cut and shoot the scripts that I want and so on in the kind of Anglo-American world is pretty much impossible. So actually I have now made sort of 4 feature-length films and I have had artistic control over all of them, but in remaining independent in this way I've remained poor.
Yes, but it's very nice of you to come in today on your bike, which I think is a beautiful cinematic image of you pedaling about. But there is something about that state that has kind of given you this film, The Market, which has got that title, which is about the free market, is about economy. You choose a kind of, I suppose, one of the purest places it can happen, someone who literally is at the mercy of powers beyond his control. You start the film by kind of giving the local currency in dollars, and I presume that's a sort of not a sly dig, but a kind of obvious dig at the way that the dollar controls the smaller economy.
So much about the film is about money and exactly how much money the character has in his pocket, and you know how much he's got to invest to turn a sufficient profit in order to reinvest in another good, and so on. It's about money. Money is, of course, after love, the most important thing. And it's not often covered in the cinema. Yeah. I mean, and there are occasionally films which, really irritate me. And, you have these characters in these amazing apartments who seem to do no work. I mean, where's the money coming from? I just thought It's Complicated with Meryl Streep, where the garden is huge and perfectly maintained by no one. There are no working class people in that film. There is no one,
She sells a lot of croissants in that film to make that garden look the way it does.
Exactly. She would have to sell a lot of croissants and have lots of Mexicans, but you don't see them. And I couldn't personally write a film like that or do a film in which money and the actual economic reality is not taken seriously.
So instead you turn to the East Turkey, an estate which I suppose is populated by people who are constantly involved in a hard scrabble for existence itself.
Eastern Turkey is a very poor part of Turkey. I mean, Turkey, especially back then, the film is set in 94, was poorer. I mean, it's now doing better, but this is a very poor area where people are struggling to to keep up a subsistence, and in that kind of, let's say, less sophisticated economy, capitalism itself is in a purer state. It is about pazarlık, they call it, the ability to trade, the ability to bargain, the ability to haggle and get the best price is part of the Turkish let's say, skill set.
But it goes back to, it almost goes back to sort of fairy tales and fables. One thinks it's like Jack and the Beanstalk with the three beans and what you can get for a cow, that sort of thing. And it's one of those places you can set something that is an eternal and timeless piece.
In wanting to make a film about capitalism and about its global reach and about its the way that even in a very sort of remote and desolate and rather poor area, global capitalism has its reach. This is, you know, the theme of the film. If you see the film, that will make sense by the end.
Well, because he's trying to get mobile phones, for example, so technology is coming to this town.
He's trying to find capital so that he can buy the rights to open a mobile phone shop, because mobile phones are just being opened in 1994 in the east of Turkey. And this connects with his uncle's factory, which is actually purifying coltan, which comes from Africa, which is then purified in places like Azerbaijan and East Turkey, and then forwarded to Finland, where it's put into Nokia phones. You know, this is the kind of global reach that I'm talking about. And so even this small-time black market trader is somehow connected in a network to a civil war in Congo and the massive profits of Nokia in Finland. And, you know, it's all connected.
How did a nice boy like you from North London get into Eastern Turkey to make a film like this? It's not, you know, a natural fit. It's not a natural progression. I mean, you know, one goes to the British film system, one doesn't normally end up there.
Yeah, well, it's even weirder than that. It's because I was in Afghanistan that I ended up making this film in Eastern Turkey. I was in Afghanistan shooting another documentary about cluster bombs during the war in 2002, and I met an anthropologist who told me about this Afghan tribe who now live in Eastern Turkey. And then I went to Eastern Turkey to find this tribe to make a film about them called 37 Uses for a Dead Sheep.
Which was at the London Film Festival. Terrific film.
Came out 3 years ago. And whilst researching this tribe who now live in Eastern Turkey, I began to imagine setting this story, which I had about a black market trader in the same area. So it's actually an economic move on my part to research two projects at the same time on the same flight ticket to save my money.
What other Turkish stories do I have up my sleeve? This film, particularly The Market, seems to me quite accessible. I mean,
I always think I'm making quite commercial mainstream films, and then I'm always surprised to find that they're being treated as art films. This film, what I really wanted to do was do something very simple, which the best Hollywood films do, which is create a character who we really care about, who we want to win, and we want this guy to succeed. And the film works, I think, because people love the main character played by Tai Ansh. He plays it charismatically, he plays it brilliantly. People want this guy to win, and they're really upset when he doesn't, or when he has to do something a bit kind of naughty.
There's a bit of Del Boy about him.
Yes, Del Boy is actually, strangely enough, one of the inspirations for the character.
Really? I can't believe you even know who Del Boy is. So rarefied is your history.
Everyone knows who Del Boy is, I think. And so I just wanted, yeah, the audience to be in the character's pocket and really want him to win. Yeah. And this is a very Hollywood thing. So I thought it's kind of a mainstream thing. But because it's in Turkish, because it's also about capitalism and the economy and so on, because it's well made, unlike Mamma Mia or something like that, we actually know how to make films.
There's talking of Mamma Mia, you do actually kind of put some songs in your film, yeah, which is kind of a little kind of breath of fresh air. They come as they're a beautiful singer who delivers some great songs as well. She's like sort of acts as our chorus to it. And gives me, where did you get the idea for that? Is that something that is part of this folkloric tradition out there?
Well, I mean, the Oriental tradition of a storyteller is obviously behind that. It's also Brecht's late plays, in which Brecht often uses a singer or a narrator to interpolate the action. And so, yes, I think it's a mixture of Oriental tradition and Brecht. And also, again, I thought if there's a musical element, because Turkish music is so seductive and nice, again, I thought it might make it more commercial.
It might get people dancing. My favourite scene is a scene in a sort of gambling den where they're gambling, and your camera kind of drifts over. There's two rather fat Turkish men who are kind of shouting at each other in this kind of strange high-pitched singing voice. Is that, did you invent that? Is that a song you meant, or is that a scene that occurred to you, that you'd seen happen? And just, what on earth are they going on about?
This is a scene where the main character is gambling in a tea house, where everyone's playing a game called OK and also cards. And in these places, occasionally people burst into song. This is a Kurdish area of Turkey, and this is a Kurdish song. It's a wedding song, actually, and the two Dengbesh, the Dengbesh are kind of poet singers of Kurdistan, and they're singing to each other as they play cards. And it's I've seen it once in real life, and it was very enchanting. So I, you know, found a way of fitting it into the film.
Yeah, no, it was absolutely transporting, a fantastic way. I mean, you immersed yourself in Turkish culture as well. You learned Turkish, you speak Turkish now.
I speak Turkish. I spent a lot of time there for the two films, yeah, and learned Turkish and now live there. I mean, I live in Istanbul and Berlin. I kind of live between those two places.
You're like Fatih Akin, whose film Crossing the Bridge is about Turkish music as well.
Yes. Yeah,
and he lives in Berlin sometimes. And
Hamburg. He's a Hamburger.
Is he a Hamburger?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's a hamburger.
Right. Well, The Market is getting a release here in the UK, a limited release, alas, but it is getting one at the Rich Mix and at the NFT.
Yes. BFI South Bank, as it's now known.
Sorry, indeed. Yeah. But it is playing at the NFT studio. Where can we see it if we go there?
It opens Friday the 16th, and it's on it for 2 weeks at the National Film Theatre or the BFI South Bank and at the Rich Mix Cinemas.
Where
I assume
there's quite a Turkish, I mean, the Rio in Dawson's just up the road, there's quite a Turkish film festival kind of audience there.
I'm hoping that a lot of the Turks will come down the Kingsland Road to Rich Mix and watch it there.
Yeah. What are their thoughts on a London boy, a British bloke, going over and making a Turkish movie? Are they receptive to such things?
It was, of course, a bit scary for me to show the film at the Antalya Film Festival, which is the big kind of... the awards there are like the Turkish BAFTAs or the Turkish Oscars or whatever. We were in the national competition as a Turkish film, and the film went down incredibly well, and I was incredibly relieved because I was scared that I would be thought of as this kind of weird foreigner who'd made a false depiction of Turkish life or something. But they loved it. In fact, we won the best film prize, beating all the Turkish filmmakers, you know, the famous ones like Nuri Bilge Ceylan.
Did he must have been chuffed about that. He's not the happiest person at the best of times.
The time that he lost, that he didn't win last time, he managed to have a heart attack to upstage the winner and an ambulance arriving to take him away. This time he didn't have a heart attack. But he went off in a huff, I think.
Yeah, this was Climates you must have beaten.
Is Three Monkeys.
Oh,
this
you beat Three Monkeys. Well, yeah. I didn't like that film.
I love Ceylan's films, but not Three Monkeys.
Yeah. So you beat that. So you actually had to get up on stage and kind of thank the Turks in Turkish.
In Turkish, yeah.
For winning their national film prize.
Yes. I got up and I said, I'm very happy. I said this in Turkish. I'm very happy. And I realised I didn't look very happy. So I said, this is what an English person looks like when they're happy. It got a big laugh.
There you go. Get off after that. Ben Hopkins, I should leave you on a high point as well. Congratulations on winning that prize. And best of luck with The Market here. Let's hope that The Market itself is responsive to the woes and travails of your hero, Mirham. Ben Hopkins, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
And as you heard from Ben Hopkins there, The Market is on a criminally limited release from this Friday, the 16th of April, playing at BFI South Bank and the Rich Mix in Shoreditch, both in London, of course. Now, on limited release himself, I'm joined by Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Not because you're just out from somewhere, but because
on
we see
day
you all
release,
too rarely.
Tagged, yes. too rarely. All too rarely.
Thanks for joining me this week to review Roman Polanski's return with The Ghost, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant with their memories of teenage life for their directorial debut, Cemetery Junction, and Jude Law and Forest Whitaker together at last in Repo Men, a high-concept sci-fi thriller. So we'll start with The Ghost, but before we review The Ghost, let's have a little clip of Mr. Polanski's work. Here's Ewan McGregor playing the ghost writer going to meet his publishers to get the gig of writing the memoirs of disgraced former Prime Minister Adam Lang, played by Pierce Brosnan, of course.
All right, I gather from Rick you're aware of the situation. Perhaps you can enlighten us and tell us what exactly you're going to bring to this project.
Nothing. is...
No, I'm not going to pretend to be someone I'm not. You have my CV.
His last effort was the autobiography of a magician. I came, I soared, I conquered.
Yeah, and it went straight to number one. So.
After you turned it down, Roy. Look, I don't read political memoirs. Who does? And I gather you spent $10 million in this book. Well, how much of that are you going to see back? Two? Three? It's bad news for your shareholders. And it's worse news for your client, Mr. Kroll. Adam Lang, he wants a place in history, not in the remainder tables.
Oh, please.
It's because I know nothing about politics that I'll ask the questions that get right to the heart of who Adam Lang is. And that is what sells autobiographies. Heart.
There's Ewan McGregor sounding a bit like Michael Caine in Polanski's return to form, I think, The Ghost.
I think a terrific return to form. His most purely enjoyable film for an awfully long time. Not very showy or arty, except for a rather Hitchcockian final image, which I thought was great.
Yep.
I think it's his best film for a long time. Better, I would dare say, than his solemnly regarded The Pianist.
Yes, and I think it's sort of a lot of lightness to it.
Yeah.
A great sort of touch. Just tell us a bit about why it kind of drew you in, the characters, and what sort of ground we're on here.
We're on almost deliciously insolent satirical ground. The main character, Adam Lang, and his wife Ruth are clearly inspired by, if not based on, Tony and Cherie Blair. There's an awful lot of unrewarding blather to be had about whether or not they're really based on Tony and Cherie Blair. Of course they are, don't be ridiculous. And I suspect there's a kind of almost extra textual thrill in knowing that you can poke and jibe Tony and Cherie, knowing that they won't sue you for precisely the reasons that the fictional Adam Lang is in. He doesn't want to get involved in a legal discussion of exactly the ways in which he could be compared to a war criminal. Tony Blair is very unlikely indeed to want to get into that. So you can, as it were, stick through the bars of his cage with almost impunity.
And he'll sort of
smile back at you with a clenched teeth. And that's what makes the film, and indeed Robert Harris's original book, such kind of outrageously kind of funny and sort of deliciously exciting.
But also very believable as well.
Very believable,
I mean,
it never
tips into parody, which is what I quite like. You never get the feeling that Pierce Brosnan or Olivia Williams are doing impressions. They're not Michael Sheen and Helen McCrory in The Queen.
Absolutely not. That's what's so clever. They sort of are. You know, it's a night's move away from their characters. And the situation itself isn't a kind of... It's not like Michael Dobbs, as it were. It's kind of classy. It looks and sounds real. It's been extensively researched. It has that kind of Robert Harris patina of classiness. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's about a ghostwriter whose name we never know, who's going to write the memoirs.
Again, very cleverly worked by Robert Harris, adapting his own screenplay. Very cleverly done, so you don't quite realise that each time there's some reason why you never hear his name. Really smart.
Is it a spoiler to give away why, I presume?
I don't want to get involved in it, no. But it's not a particular spoiler, but it's just a part of his self-effacing kind of ironic alienation from events that he is shortly going to be at the heart of.
Because that's one of the themes of the book as well, is exile, because the Prime Minister is in some... It's supposed to be, I think, Martha's Vineyard, although I think it's shot on the German island of Sylt.
It's Cape Cod. I think it's supposed to be Cape Cod. I don't know where in Cape Cod. It's interesting because it doesn't look sunny in the way that it's always portrayed in, as it were, Sex and the City. It looks rainy and gloomy and very European.
There's that wonderful, what's that Kevin Costner film? That rather good one, No Way Out. They go to Cape Cod and they have sex.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't look like that. It looks the way in which Cape Cod may indeed look for most of the time, and it's supposed to be in the winter.
It's kind of out of season. It's like a wet Wednesday in Margate.
Yes, exactly. And that's part of what makes it so fascinating. You think it looks unusual. It looks sort of real. The location work in London, one scene in West London looked real to me. The final scenes outside the office may not have been real. I honestly couldn't get a fix on it. It may have been shot in Brussels.
I couldn't work out where if Polanski sort of hasn't gone to America to shoot.
He can't have shot it in the UK.
No, but
he must have presumably that's second unit work, I suppose. But again, stylishly done.
Maybe the ghostwriter is a metaphor for the ghosty director who maybe at night turns up in London, takes the Eurostar. We don't know he's in town.
We don't know. I mean, that's another conversation to have, is the theme of being under house arrest, of course, has obviously an ironic parallel with the Master's own situation.
Well, it didn't. I mean, it struck me as I was watching this, but presumably he'd made it before he was arrested. He finished it editing it while he was under house arrest.
Yes, it's very interesting because we live in an era of spin and management where, you know, disgraced celebrities often try to include a kind of mollified version of their own situation in their own works of art in order to exonerate themselves. And you almost think this is what's going on until you realise that the Adam Lang figure is not a nice guy at all. He's an absolute so-and-so.
In the world of elections as well, we can't ignore that's going on. This film sort of actually piqued my interest. It was far more charismatic and twisty than the actual current election tale that's going on. This sort of made me interest in politics again.
Oh, yes. I mean, it pulls off the incredible conjuring trick of making politics interesting, something that's at stake, something that's really at stake for Adam Lang and indeed for Polanski, that is to say, a prison sentence.
It reminded me of it had elements of noir, like Chandler or something. It really drew you in the way that an old, you know, Sam Spade would have. You were investigating with him.
Yeah, the idea of, you know, 3 days of the Condor, or indeed, again, we're coming close to spoilerism, John Frankenheimer's The Manchurian Candidate.
Which, handily, Peter, is it re-released?
It is indeed, and I wonder if it hasn't been cunningly timed. If it has been, that's very shrewd work.
And nice to see that this one actually kind of is worthy of the comparison as well.
Yes, absolutely. Certainly more worthy of the comparison than Jonathan Demme's awful remake.
Absolutely. Interestingly, that film, the Jonathan Demme's remake, stars Liev Schreiber as the Manchurian Candidate himself. He pops up in our next film this week, Repo Men.
That's a fantastic link.
Thank you
I
very much.
So.
I've been practicing that one. He plays the sinister head of a corporation for whom Jude Law and Forrest Whitaker work, repossessing limbs and hearts and kidneys from people who can't afford to keep up the repayments on their organ transplants. Let's see Law and Whitaker together at last in an action sci-fi thriller.
You all right?
What are you doing?
Thought you needed help.
Hey, Adam, you see I have my knife in his side?
I knocked him down. He goes on my count.
You're joking me, right?
Jake.
I've been working on this guy for 10 minutes. 10 minutes I've been working on this guy. You're going to come in here and just hit him inside the head with a pipe?
Jake.
After that link, the film might come as something of a disappointment. Jude Law and Forrest Whitaker. To me, it looked like it was Hamlet and Othello slumming it in between decent jobs on the stage.
Yeah, I've got to be honest. For the first 20 minutes, half an hour, I really enjoyed it. I thought, wow, this actually isn't bad.
It's a good concept, isn't it?
It's a fantastic high concept socked over with incredible gusto. And I thought, it's great stuff. It's nicely timed. It's a satire on private medicine. It's okay. It's outrageous and absurd. But it's good stuff. You know, this is great. This is kind of black comedy. And, you know, the two of them aren't particularly nice. I thought for a while, my goodness, this is like watching Rollerball or something like this. It's absolutely great.
So when did someone come and rip the organ out of
you? I think it was, I have to say, that talented but typecast actress Alice Braga, who tends to play the kind of the sort of siren of the underclass. She tends to get that role over and over and over again.
Poor thing.
And when Jude Law has to kind of grow a conscience and make common cause with all the sort of dispossessed in the underground world, suddenly, the temperature of the film just drops through the floor. I just couldn't care less about it. It suddenly becomes sentimental and drawn out, and all the kind of nastiness and the kind of black comedy had kind of gone.
All the balladian kind of not.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of
all the sort of
stuff, Blade, the satire that you.
Yeah,
think.
The satire. You know, the kind of, well, obviously very derivative Blade Runner-ish stuff of the cityscape.
Yeah.
Again, you know, half-inched from better films, but you know, but intelligently half-inched.
I couldn't, when I mentioned Hamlet, I couldn't, because there's a lot of stabbing in this film. There's a lot of bare bodkins in this film.
That's
and
true.
I couldn't, Jude looked very depressed
there's
and miserable
a lot of,
all the way through.
I mean, there's a lot of blood and yuckiness.
I can't say I didn't like that. A lot of stab wounds
and sort of body horror.
And a lot of it was driven. I mean, the more it went on, the more I hated it, unfortunately. I did kind of start off thinking, it was quite a good idea.
I thought it was a great idea, and I say for the first, especially that really funny scene where Liv Schreiber's trying to sell insurance policies to some sort of nerdy couple, and then Jude and Forrest crash in and go, "We've kicked some ass, boss." I thought it was funny. It was great, but then it just becomes sentimental and flaccid.
As he often is, Liev Schreiber is my favourite thing in there. But as there is a film out this week which, in which he's not connected to, I couldn't find any way to crowbar him in,
right.
To Cemetery Junction, which is Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant's directorial film debut. They obviously worked together on The Office and Extras, and Gervais has been in Hollywood as well, doing things like The Invention of Lying, and here he is playing the father of his character Freddie, who is trying to join an insurance company in 1973 Reading. Let's go back to those days of the 70s when racism and insurance lived hand in hand in suburban Britain.
Buy a policy.
No.
Who's going to pay for your funeral?
I've got a few years yet.
Not with all that fat round your heart. I know I'm not paying for it.
Like, you'll still be around when I go. Bury me in the garden if you want, I don't care.
Yeah, he buries everything in the garden. Got an old mangle down there, old cooker.
Not paying the council to take away rubbish.
Well, you better start digging a hole for him soon, because I'm not doing it.
You won't be alive when I die. You'll already be buried down there with the mangle.
In fact, remind me to do that next week, Kath.
Dad, buy a policy or I'll be out of work on Monday.
Good. You can help me dig your grandmother's grave.
The sniping granny, played by Anne Reed there. This is Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant. Surely they're going to deliver another comic masterpiece in the mould of The Office.
No. What they've done with almost awe-inspiring professionalism and savvy is delivered a very American screenplay seminar-style coming-of-age story. I mean, it's terrifically well done in a way. But just as, if I may quote this rather absurd phrase, Esther Williams, the great swimming star, that was said of her, when she's wet, she's a star, when she's dry, she ain't. Now, this film, when Ricky Gervais is in it, it's funny. And when he's not in it, well, it's not unfunny exactly, but it's sort of heartwarming.
But so did that element, the heart-tugging element, get to you? Did you care about the words? Because I found myself not really...
No,
I mean, these boys,
I didn't at all care
good.
About them. I thought it was funny when it was being funny.
Mm.
When it was being funny, it was funny, and when Ricky Gervais comes on, suddenly it's completely different. He snaps almost emphatically into classic funny Gervais Merchant mode.
He plays sort of his dad, and
when Julia Davis and Ricky Gervais and Anne Reed, suddenly it's funny, and I'm laughing. And sometimes he puts his kind of lines into the kids' mouths, and it's weird. It looks like they're like The Exorcist. These sort of stupid kids who aren't funny somehow get supernaturally possessed by very sophisticated, funny joke writers. I am a little bit suspicious of the way race is treated in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ricky, the great man, and nobody admires him more than me, does his sort of chancy kind of race gags over the kitchen table, and as it were kind of buys them off with having his characters punch some bloke for making a racist remark. So, you know, we're all on the same page, so he kind of squares it off. But there is something a little bit, you know, very kind of contemporary
There's quite a lot of jokes too about put on some macho music like Elton John, for example.
Yeah,
puffs. As well.
And it's a, you know, nice gag, but, and it socks home. It uses Elton John to crank up the kind of sympathetic and emotional connection you make in these guys. Beautifully, there is an ounce of fat on it,
but
that's not what we want
from them.
I think Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant are sort of crazy geniuses. We want something that's more
had got into the system and could subvert it through it, kind of, which I think The Invention of Lying was trying to do as well.
I'm not knocking it. It's an enjoyable movie. You could go and see that film on a Friday night and have a jolly good night out. But, you know, you sort of want something more from
him. If you watch Ricky in the director's chair series, it is as if he's swallowed the screenwriting manual. And he talks about character development arc. And you think, oh, my God, the one thing I loved about The Office was that it didn't have any of that.
No.
Although secretly it did.
Secretly it did. It did it without wanting to do it. It did it. It sort of leapfrogged all that.
Mm.
It was beyond, one step beyond all that. It had all that. He knew it anyway. He doesn't have to relearn it for the benefit of studio executives.
This is what we think. But the numbers will tell in the end, Peter.
Well, I'm afraid you're right.
Peter Bradshaw, thank you very much for joining us. If you are doing your best to avoid all the inane election harumph on at the moment, why not bathe your eyes and senses in Peter Bradshaw's ever coruscating and amusing reviews and cultural musings, all of which can be found at guardian.co.uk/film. In the last few years, there's been much trumpeting of a new generation of US directors who've been grouped together under the moniker of mumblecore. Lynn Shelton, for example, had a modest hit here in the UK with her film Hump Day last year, and she visited us here at Film Weekly. But the man who brought the idea of mumblecore into existence, and who himself has a growing reputation as a filmmaker, is writer, director and actor Andrew Bujalski. His latest feature is Beeswax. It's the story of sisters Jenny and Lauren and an old flame who's back on the scene with a change of heart.
I feel fine about it. I
feel great about it. I really do. I thought it was great. Last night was awesome. I really do.
Me too. When I went in there and she wasn't there, I got kind of excited and made me realize that I just shouldn't do it again, that's all.
And go back to Radio Silence?
Well, I mean, not Radio Silence, just, you know, maybe we could find some middle ground between Radio Silence and Hot Sex.
Hot Sex. All right. Is that what that was? Was that Hot Sex?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
I thought it was Hot Sex.
So to tell me more about the way he works and his latest feature, I'm joined on the line now by Andrew Bujalski from Austin, Texas. Welcome to Film Weekly, Andrew. How lovely to speak to you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a while. We wanted to kind of get you on the show. We missed you at the London Film Festival where Beeswax kind of had its UK premiere, and now it's coming out here in the UK. Is it difficult to get your kind of films released in the States as it is here in the UK?
Yeah, sure. I think as everybody complains about all the time, it's a very difficult moment in history for small films like this.
You're not in 3D. Forgive me if I'm wrong. Maybe I just wasn't wearing the glasses. You haven't got the big budget. You haven't got the stars involved, and yet you continue to make films this way. Why do you bother?
I mean, this is a question that crops up from time to time.
I'm glad you do, if I may say, as a critic. It's lovely to see it, but I'm lucky because I get to watch the whole kind of, you know, the broad church of product, if you know what I mean. So yours come as a great refreshment to me, having sort of watched Clash of the Titans and How to Train Your Dragon, then I can watch Beeswax. It's straight, you know, that for me, that's the fruit bowl of cinema, if you like.
I'm thinking of doing my next film in 1D.
Oh, well... That'll be another refreshing aspect as well. Tell us about the making of this film, and particularly your two lead characters, the sisters there. They're non-professional actors, aren't they?
Yeah, Tilly and Maggie Hatcher. I mean, the genesis of that film, there would be no film without them. I'd known them for 10-plus years and had fantasized for a long time about making a film with them. I just find them to be immensely charismatic people. I'd met Maggie first years and years ago, and was kind of bowled over by her charm, then found out shortly thereafter that she had a twin sister who was equally charming, but a completely different sort of person. And I think, you know, like many people who are not twins themselves, I find twins completely fascinating.
Yeah, you and Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think there's something inherently cinematic about twins.
And were they receptive to working? Because obviously they deliver both very good performances. And, you know, if I was an actor and I'd been to, you know, the School of Dramatic Arts or RADA, and these people come along and they've never acted before and they deliver these kind of beautifully nuanced performances that are both witty and wise and funny and moving, you make me think about, why have I studied all this time? These two come along and just deliver this performance. Is it something about the style that you work, that naturalism that you kind of demand that makes it easy for them to work and deliver these performances?
Well, just in writing the script, first of all, I wrote it with the two of them in mind. Mm-hmm. So I know, you know, they're not trained actors, but I do have a sense of what I think they're going to project on the screen, what I think their performance styles are going to be, just based on knowing them as people. So in that sense, we have tipped the scales. They do have an advantage going into this.
Sure. So is it improvised, Andrew, or have we got a sort of set script here that you're working from, or do you do a Mike Lee thing and then work with shop it, and then there's a script at the end of that?
I guess it's a little of all that. There is a set script. I write a very conventional-looking screenplay. I write several drafts of it, and I try to get it as perfect as I can get it. But then when we get to set, it's the only thing that matters is that it works on the screen. You know, when all is said and done, when it's up on the screen, I don't care if anybody thinks I wrote a great screenplay or not. Nobody's coming to see the screenplay. So there is always room for actors to bring something else.
But it's always the kind of the very naturalistic kind of expressions, almost the banalities. I mean, are there in your screenplay, it's the nice to meet yous and the thank yous and all that kind of real stuff that people actually say that, you know, most screenplays would kind of go, well, get rid of that. That's not important right now. Those kind of goodbye, hello, the opening of the doors, all those kind of things. It's almost as if you concentrate on the bits that other people would kind of jettison from their screenplay.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, Hitchcock has that famous quote about movies are like life with all the boring parts cut out. I'm mangling the quote, I apologize. But yeah, certainly sometimes I have the sensation that I'm putting the boring parts back in because I don't find them boring. I mean, ultimately that's what it comes down to, is to me there's a lot of drama in those small interactions. This is just what I experience in my own everyday life, that these small things, these, as you say, banalities, usually there's a lot being communicated in them. Maybe not usually. Sometimes there's a lot being communicated in them. And I feel like I can... You know, there's enough there for me to build a story out of.
I love hearing it because I always think, well, you know, in every nice to meet you or nice working with you and all that, there's always such a loaded kind of undercurrent in that kind of stuff. And you Americans are very good at that. You know, you can make have a nice day mean, you know, go fuck yourself.
Right.
Or I never want to see you again. Or, I'm gonna raise the subject because you said you don't want to be kind of associated with any kind of movement or whatever, but somehow you've been lumped into this mumblecore movement. And in fact, you're the reason that you're lumped into it because you came up with the expression mumblecore. Can you just tell us about that? Because it's one of those movements that either you've heard of it in this country, in the UK, or you haven't. And while we had Lynn Shelton on the show a couple of months ago with her film Hump Day, and you know, talked about it with her as well. She's from Portland, Oregon, not Austin, Texas at all. But there is a sort of way of trying to kind of put you new filmmakers together, and mumblecore seems to be the one that's stuck. But I got a feeling that you're not so proud of that.
No, well, you know, maybe I'm getting used to it because I have no choice, but yeah, of course, my fear of it has always been that it's a reductive label, and that it's a kind of quick way for people to dismiss a lot of films, but basically, I feel like if you take all the films that have been stuck under that label, and if you look at, you know, over the years, quite a few films have been stuck at that label, some of them that really don't resemble other films stuck with that label whatsoever, it's the differences between the films that make them interesting. It's not the similarities. That's what I fear about it, is that if you say, well, these are the movies in which young white people talk to each other, you know, I don't want to go see a movie of that description any more than anybody else does. I don't think my films are interesting because young white people talk to each other in them. I don't find that any more inherently interesting than anybody else. It's there are other things going on in the films. There are deeper things going on in the films.
So how did you come up with the term? I mean, it's quite a good term. That's what I wish I'd coined it.
Oh no, I didn't. You know, I was sitting next to Eric Masanaga, who was the sound mixer on my first two films, at South by Southwest in 2005. We were in a film screening, and I was joking around with him, and I said, you know, hey Eric, you know, these bloggers here are saying there's a movement. What would you call this movement? And he just immediately came up with that, and I thought it was funny, so I made the terrible mistake of repeating it to a journalist months later, and then it's oddly laid dormant for a couple of years, and then suddenly the word seemed to explode a few years later. I mean, it is very interesting to have been present at the birth of a neologism. It's a funny feeling.
You should be pleased with that. I mean, I know you can enter your own things in Wikipedia now, and they'll stick. But mumblecore's a pretty good one, and I feel you are going to be stuck with it. Whether you like it, we journalists to whom you must never mention anything you want to keep private.
I know.
I gather that your most kind of imminent production is a child, because you're about to have a baby. Is that correct?
Yes, which certainly changes the game plan
there,
here.
You go. You see, you'll be writing about babies from now on. You see, it's a whole new world of material, so it's worth doing for that, you know.
When
is that due?
About a month and a half.
Well, we wish you the very best of luck with that, as we do with the release of Beeswax here in the UK. Enjoy your sleep while you can. And for now, Andrew Bodowski, thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly, and speak to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Again, a film on limited release, Beeswax, is showing at the ICA here in London. For more information, go to ica.org.uk. And that's all we have for you this week. The music featured on this week's podcast is from Alexandre Desplat. Again, we use him all the time. This is his tense and propulsive score to Roman Polanski's The Ghost, an excellent piece of work. Don't forget to pick up The Observer this Sunday for my trailer trash column and my 10 best can moments. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, he's back. It's Jason Phipps, and it's goodbye. Till next week.